Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with William Barr's testimony today before the Senate Appropriations Committee, where he went further in tipping his hand as a partisan protector of Trump by venturing into the fevered swamp of anti-Trump deep state conspiracies in saying he will be looking into the genesis of the FBI's counterintelligence investigation of the Trump campaign and its ties to Russia, adding that, quote, "I think spying did occur." This has Trump crowing that Barr is doing a great job and he's, quote, "getting started on going back to the origins of where exactly this all started because it was an illegal witch hunt." Michael German, a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, who served as a special agent with the FBI specializing in domestic terrorism and covert operations, joins us. We'll discuss indications that Barr is moving to put his own spin on the report expected soon from the FBI's Inspector General's internal investigation into the FBI's handling of its counterintelligence investigation into the Trump campaign, just as Barr put his own pro-Trump spin on the Mueller report before it was released with his four-page summary, which Trump is celebrating as an exoneration. Then, with Obama warning the Democrats are in danger of forming a circular firing squad as progressive purity overwhelms pragmatism, and Nancy Pelosi remarking in an apparent dig at AOC that, quote, "while there are people who have a large number of Twitter followers, what's important is that we have large numbers of votes on the floor of the House." We'll examine whether a division between centrists and progressives will split the Democratic Party and sink their chances of ousting Trump in 2020. Simon Rosenberg, the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, who worked on the Clinton presidential campaign as a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room, joins us to discuss the findings in a new survey that half of Democratic-leaning voters are moderate or conservative, with a quarter progressive and only 1 in 10 identifying as Democratic Socialists. Then finally, with Trump essentially placing himself above the law as he defiantly fights the move underway by the House Ways and Means Committee to have the IRS turn over the past 6 years of his tax returns, we will speak with Edward Kleinbard, a professor of law at USC who served as chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. He joins us to discuss his op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, "The Law is Clear on Disclosing Trump's Tax Returns to the House Ways and Means Committee," and how Trump's hysterical overreaction and his Treasury Secretary's clumsy and lame defense of the indefensible point to a major cover-up of damaging information. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Michael German, a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. Previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union Washington Legislative Office, and he's a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael German.
Thank you.
So what did you make of today's Senate hearings before the Senate Appropriations Committee, at which Attorney General William Barr told lawmakers that he'd be looking into the genesis of the FBI's counterintelligence investigation into potential ties between Trump and his campaign and the Russian government beginning in 2016. And he went on to say, "I think spying on a political campaign is a big deal. I think spying did occur. The question is whether it was adequately predicated." What did you make of that?
So I think spying on a presidential campaign is a big deal as well. And I think all FBI investigations should be predicated. I think it was very dangerous the way Barr couched his remarks at this hearing, seeming to reinforce this Trump narrative that somehow a an investigation of the campaign was launched for improper reasons and that the Mueller investigation was a witch hunt. And, you know, particularly because of the way that Barr was nominated after explaining why the president should be exonerated for obstruction, the concern was that he was already somebody who was known as a very partisan attorney general on his first visit to that office, that he would continue to be in a more dangerous role, actually trying to protect the president. And the way he couched his remarks, it was troubling, where he suggested that Congress used to be concerned about this, but they aren't now, that it was targeting the Trump campaign, those kinds of remarks. And his framing of the rules that were put in place after the Vietnam era, Hoover administration spying on political protesters, might somehow have been violated, when what he doesn't acknowledge is that those rules were mostly erased after 9/11 and more thoroughly in 2008. So all the predication that's required for the FBI to open a preliminary investigation is an allegation or information, which is a very low standard,
right,
just regularly. But a 2010 Inspector General report revealed that the FBI agents were actually making their own allegations to justify preliminary investigations of political groups. So this has been a longstanding problem, and rather than focusing on whether one campaign was improperly investigated, I would hope that the Attorney General is more interested in the broader problem of the FBI abusing these overbroad authorities.
Well, it looks as if Trump has already picked up on what Barr said. He said that today that Barr is doing a great job and he's getting started on going back to the origins. Of course, he had some problems with that word. He kept calling oranges. But the origins of where exactly this all started, because it was an illegal witch hunt. This was an attempted coup. This was an attempted takedown of a president. So Barr is clearly Trump is obviously responding to Barr's testimony.
Right. And like I said, you know, the way he couched his remarks is highly politicized. And it's also highly politicized because, as he acknowledged in his remarks, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice is already investigating this issue. So it seems as if this might be an attempt for the Attorney General to put something out in advance of that report, somehow challenge the Inspector General's independent review of the matter, or put out alternative facts that might make the story look very different, in much the way he did with the Mueller report by putting out a very short summary.
Right.
That was, you know, had the buzzwords that were picked up in the political discourse without really having any information any objective reviewer could determine were accurate or inaccurate.
Well, short of that, and there's certainly indications that may well be the case, certainly with the four-page memo did not reflect the 400-page report, not that we've seen that yet, but clearly what's happening here is that Barr is feeding this kind of fever swamp of deep state anti-Trump conspiracy theory fantasies that are so active on the political right. And it's not as if those people need any encouragement.
Right. And, you know, particularly using a term like spying to talk about the investigation of allegations against members of the Trump campaign and talking about it as spying on the campaign rather than investigating allegations against particular individuals who might have previously or actively be involved in the campaign. That, again, sort of feeds the narrative that this was somehow improper conduct done for political purposes. And, you know, I'm perfectly willing to wait for the IG report. Certainly it was highly critical of the way that the Hillary Clinton investigation was handled by the FBI. So I don't doubt that they'll find serious problems that they were involved in this case, because, again, you know, I am somebody who has long argued that the FBI needs more oversight. So I welcome the Attorney General's contribution to my side of that argument, but I hope that it's broad enough to encompass all improper investigation and intelligence gathering activities of the FBI and the other intelligence agencies, rather than justifying investigations of people they don't like while criticizing investigations of people they do like.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael German, who's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. Previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union Washington Legislative Office, and he's a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. So the Inspector General of the DOJ, Michael Horowitz, you think he's doing a good job? What's your opinion? He's not like Barr, who's tipped his hand politically.
Right. Right. He appears to be doing a very workmanlike investigation of the issues. The report that he put out on the problems with the Hillary Clinton investigation, I think, was very sober and frank and legitimately criticized wrongdoing by high-level officials in the FBI. And I would not be surprised that there weren't other improper activities and abuses of authority involved in this investigation as well. I mean, just the fact that you have high-level FBI officials writing books and going on speaking tours talking about what is or has been an active investigation, that's normally considered inappropriate for a witness to be doing that, much less an official of the FBI to be prejudging an investigation publicly. So, you know, I won't be surprised that there isn't severe criticism, but whether that suggests a political motive to target the Trump campaign with a political investigation, I don't see any evidence of that. And in fact, I would argue that there was plenty of investigation that should have taken place long before it started.
Right. Well, I wouldn't make excuses for the deputy head of the FBI, McCabe, but he was fired the day before he qualified for his pension. So that
actually is something that was very common at the FBI. And I had complained about it and testified before Congress about the need for better protections for FBI employees. And, you know, he was the deputy director and could have changed those rules. So, you know, while I think it's improper to use the tools of internal enforcement in that way, he's the last person I'm gonna shed a tear over when plenty of other people who never had an ability to change the rules were hurt by them.
Well, just in the last two or three minutes here, let's talk a little about why it seems a little suspicious that Barr has brought this up. And we know that Devin Nunes is sending him a list of people that he believes lied to Congress, misled Congress, and leaked classified information. And, you know, most of that seems to be in the kind of weird sort of deep state fantasy world. But there were some specific incidences where, for example, Papadopoulos was in London. He had drinks with an Australian diplomat. He made the mistake of drinking with an Australian who drank him under the table. And he blabbed about the fact that the Trump campaign were getting dirt on Hillary Clinton from the Russians. And that got to the FBI, and that apparently prompted an investigation. And that seems perfectly proper and logical. And also, we know that Carter Page had a couple of FSB, Russian intelligence officers here in the United States, had tried to recruit him, and they had sent word back to Moscow that they thought he was a greedy idiot, and that information was intercepted. So they had every reason to put FISA warrants out on Carter Page, did they not?
So, you know, I think the information that has already been published is very thorough in the amount of detail that was in that warrant. I mean, people suggest that the level of evidence needed to get a FISA warrant is somehow very high, and that's not the case, but it's not the case across the board. And again, suggesting that the person that you like being targeted with an investigation is improper when you completely support the use of FBI authorities to suppress political movements you don't like is the problem, right? And your question is a good one, because it was interesting that 2010 Inspector General report on the FBI spying of domestic advocacy groups determined that because the standard was so low, it basically documented a lot of inappropriate spying on groups that were just engaged in political activities where there was no evidence they were actually involved in any kind of breaking of federal laws. But it said that because the FBI standards were so low, requiring just an allegation, and that FBI agents could make their own allegation, that it wasn't an actual violation of the rules. And since then, the rules have actually been watered down even more. But the problem that was not tackled by the Inspector General then, who was Glenn Fine, not the current Inspector General Michael Horowitz, but was, you know, because those standards are so low, you can investigate anyone. The FBI can investigate anyone. They can make an allegation against anyone if that's all that's required to justify an investigation. So why was it that it was only these environmentalists and anti-war movement types and animal rights groups that were being spied on?
Right.
It's because, you know, if you can investigate anyone, but you're only investigating people whose politics you don't like and not investigating people whose politics you do like, that's where the problem comes in. You know, and the only way you avoid that is by raising the standard again, as we did after, as Barr said, the Vietnam War era spying was uncovered, establishing a rule that requires actual evidence of wrongdoing before you can engage in any kind of investigation that would suppress the legitimate activities of protest groups.
Well, Michael German, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael German, who's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice at Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. Previously served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union, Washington Legislative Office, and he's a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining whether the division between centrists and progressives will split the Democratic Party and sink their chances of ousting Trump in 2020. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Simon Rosenberg, the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News for 5 years before working on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. Welcome to Background Briefing, Simon Rosenberg.
It's good to be here, Ian. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, thanks, Simon. And let's talk about some of the remarks from President Obama last Saturday in Berlin. He talked about the Democrats ahead of the 2020 elections appearing to be forming a circular firing squad where progressive purity is trumping pragmatism. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's an ongoing tension in the party. And I, you know, I will say, as somebody who's been working full-time in Democratic politics since 1992, I think on balance, the party is getting along, people are getting along better than perhaps any other period that I've worked in Democratic politics. I think there really isn't a broad appetite for inter-party wars. I think there is a clear understanding that you know, defeating Trump and defeating Trumpism is of paramount importance. And I think that the kind of inter-party squabbles that you're seeing right now are almost normal. You know what I mean? Like I don't know that we should expect it to be any other way. I mean, people are passionate about their views, and parties are a never-ending, ongoing internal debate and fight for power. And so I think that his remarks got a lot of press, but I think that it's in context of him just saying to remind everybody, hey, don't allow differences and disagreements turn into disputes and arguments and fights, right? That these are, we're all on the same team and we've got to work these things through. And so I think this is within the bounds of what one should expect out of a major American political party.
Well, I think in essence he was saying, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Absolutely.
But yeah. He also made subsequent remarks about the call for reparations, which a number of Democratic presidential candidates are getting aboard, saying that it was impractical, expensive, and divisive.
Yeah, look, I think that what's exciting about right now in this moment is that there is a, you know, I think it's very clear from watching this presidential debate, the early presidential campaign, that the Democratic Party doesn't really know where it's going to go, right? That there isn't a clear sense of where we're going to be 18 months from now, 2 years from now. And I think it makes this moment exciting, frankly, and that these debates are really consequential. And I think what I'm happy about is that we have really talented presidential candidates signing up to be part of this debate. I mean, I think that we should all, you know, I'm constantly amazed at how talented and deep the bench is in the Democratic Party. And look, I have my own very strong views about many of these issues, but I also know that I'm in a party where there are a lot of people that don't agree with me on many things. And that's okay, right? I expect that. And I think the one thing that I will say that worries me is that some of the freshman members of Congress who just got here, who are from districts that are not competitive, are spending time and energy raising money and challenging other Democrats rather than fighting Republicans. I think that's a mistake. I think that's a mistake, and that's part of what I think Obama was alluding to, right, is that I think that this idea that, you know, at this moment that any Democratic organization should be spending time and money trying to dislodge other Democrats instead of defeat Trump and beat the Republicans is just self-indulgent and silly in my mind, to be honest. I mean, there's a time for these kinds of inter-party squabbles. In fact, that's what a presidential debate is, right? We're going to have a big debate. We're actually allowing all that to take place. What can't happen, though, is that, you know, we can't look back. I've been through two elections, 2000 and 2016, that were decided by a handful of votes in a small number of states. And if we look back and there was a big chunk of our party that was working to defeat other Democrats and not defeat Trump, and we don't win the election, right? I mean, I think we've been through that, Ian, right? And we don't ever want to go through that again. So I think that part of what the president was saying is you're exactly right. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We have to work together, respect one another's differences, whatever, and there are many among us, and come together at the end around a common purpose and a common goal. I think that's going to be easier to achieve this cycle than in many other Democratic presidential cycles, with the exception of whether if Bernie Sanders gets the nomination. I think there will be enormous resistance. I think he's going to have a very hard time uniting the Democratic Party around him, in part because he's not a Democrat, right? Like, he hasn't earned the respect of other Democrats through being part of our family for the last generation of American politics. But I think all the other candidates will be successful in bringing the party together is my own sense.
But isn't it possible, in fact likely, Simon, that the electorate has moved to the left? We know that the younger generation has, those saddled with student debt. The S word, socialism, is no longer a dirty word, and to some extent you can credit Bernie Sanders for that.
Yep.
So for the longest time, centrist Democrats have been trying to, you know, reach out to the center-right. But I don't think there's a center-right anymore. I mean, wouldn't it make more sense for the center-left to work with the progressive left?
Yeah, I that's part of what I'm saying, Ian, is that I mean that we're all part of the same dysfunctional diverse family, and that you know, we have to. I mean, my organization never attacks other Democrats ever. I mean, we make the statement for what we believe, and we frankly are focused on defeating what we think is a far more virulent danger to the Republic, the Republican Party, than my brothers and sisters and our party. And I think that what I will say, that getting to what you're getting at, is that let's look at what happened in 2018. Right, there was a test case. I was a senior advisor to the DCCC. I helped set the national strategy for the House Democrats in the 2018 election. And you know, when again and again, Democratic voters in primaries were offered, in some cases, many, many choices, right, of candidates. And in almost every case in the House races, the pragmatist won the nomination in the Democratic primaries and then went on to win the election. If you take California, where you're from, right, there were seven races that we ended up winning. And all seven of those races, in a multi-candidate primary, the pragmatist, the person with life experience who was not a deeply ideological candidate, you know, prevailed in the primary and ended up prevailing in the general. And so I think that one thing that I don't yet believe that there is clear data that the Democratic primary audience has run to the left. I don't think that there's a clear things you can point to that says that, you know, I mean, let's just take Bernie Sanders, right? I mean, he got over 40% of the vote in 2016. He's at 20% right now. I mean, he and Elizabeth Warren together are somewhere between 25 and 30% of the vote, right, at this point. And the person who's leading in the field, Joe Biden, is probably the most identified with pragmatism and sort of establishment politics of anybody in the race right now. So I think that there's, the way I like to think about this is that there's a tension here. It's an unresolved tension. There are parts of the family that are trying to move the party to the left. That's been the case for the entire time I've been in Democratic politics. And then there's others who are in a more, you know, who want to work with everybody to get things done, who view politics less through an ideological lens and more through a pragmatic one, which is, I want to roll up my sleeves, work with Republicans, work with Democrats to try to get things done for the American people, and who don't come at the game with the level of ideological intensity that others may have in the family. The key thing is, that's what you said at the beginning, we all have to learn how to work with one another when we don't agree with one another, too, right? And so I think that I'm a little bit more sanguine about all of this than some of my brethren are about this. I think the kind of stuff we're seeing play out is normal and expected in our system, because our parties are so big, right? They represent 45 to 50% of the country. We're not a parliamentary democracy where a political party can represent 25 or 30% of the electorate. We have to become comfortable with difference and resolving differences inside the family. So I'm optimistic. I'm not saying that we couldn't have a debilitating internal fight. I just don't think you see it playing out right now. I mean, I think there were some skirmishes early on, you know, in the heyday, you know, the heady days after, you know, we took the House over. But I think the real question is going to be is, how does Bernie handle this? Because Bernie is going to be the most powerful articulator of a more divisive internal strategy inside the Democratic Party, right? He's taking positions that are really at odds with where Nancy Pelosi is, where the Democratic Party was in 2018, where many of our candidates have been, and he wants to have this fight. And the question that I think will be interesting is, how, when we see these primary debates play out in June and July and in the fall, does Bernie sound strident, angry, petulant, or does he sound like somebody who can disagree without being disagreeable, right? Because he's going to disagree in very virulent ways with other candidates who are on stage with him. And I think his ability to not make it look like that he's got animus towards other Democrats is going to be the key to his success, because he can't win the nomination with 20%, right? He's going to have to get up into the 30s, and whoever wins the nomination is going to have to get up into the 30s. And Bernie's a long way away from that. He may be closer to that than some of the other candidates, but you know, I think it's going to be, I think attacking other Democrats in this environment is a losing strategy for any candidate right now.
So do you think, though, that the progressives like Ocasio-Cortez,
yeah,
Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, etc., are getting too much oxygen? They're certainly getting most of the headlines, and that Nancy Pelosi seemed to have taken a sort of mild shot at them because because AOC's got about 4 million Twitter followers. I think Nancy's a little under that. But basically what she said was, while there are people who have a large number of Twitter followers, what's important is that we have a large number of votes on the floors of the House. So obviously, when you talk about what happened in 2018, what happened in 2018, even though AOC did get a lot of headlines from knocking off a long-term Democratic incumbent, what changed the House numbers to the Democratic column were people that got elected in red states or purple states who
were swing districts,
they were the ones who changed it. So doesn't that logic apply in 2020?
Listen, yes, it does. And in fact, of the 59 freshman Democrats, right, 40 of them have joined the New Democrat Coalition, the group of sort of pragmatists, if you want to call that, in the House. So two-thirds of those who just got elected have publicly identified themselves with sort of the pragmatic politics of the New Democrats. And so I do think, but again, I believe that AOC and her colleagues have every right in the world to be doing what they're doing, right? I may disagree with them, but I also think it's part of our system in the way that I think that Republicans have every right in the world to be pursuing, the policies that they believe are correct. I think that what's incumbent upon us, and I've given advice to many of the moderate and pragmatic Democrats, is that we have to become louder, right? Like that. I think, one of the things you and I discussed earlier before we went on the air is that, there's sort of the dominance on Twitter and social media by sort of more, liberal or more, more liberal voices. Well, that can be changed, right? I mean, the moderates have to show up and be louder, and we have to, this is where the debate is. You got to go where the debate is. And I've been very aggressive with many of the people I know on the Hill that we, have to be using modern tools to communicate to voters in the way that they are being want to be communicated with now, and that you can't concede any way of communicating to any ideological faction. You have to use all the tools in your toolbox to reach people. And the truth is that for a huge percentage of Democratic voters, 40, 45, 50% of Democratic voters, they've migrated post-television. They're now living on the internet to get their information. And so, there becomes a prerequisite to being louder. It's one of the ways that we won the House back in 2018. We had a direct strategy to help those swing district Democrats raise their own money so they could tell their own story in their own voice using modern tools, reaching all sorts of voters as a way of prevailing. That's not how we ran our campaigns in 2016. We were overly reliant on independent organizations, and it's our belief that the best way to tell our story is to allow candidates to have the resources they need to tell the story about themselves in the way that they want. And that's why I think that as we go ahead into 2020, I do think that there is going to be a very vigorous debate about all these issues, and I think that's healthy, by the way. I mean, if moderates don't like the Green New Deal, then they've got to come up with their own plan and go out and sell it. If they don't like single-payer health care, we've got to be loud and aggressive about what our alternative is, right? And we shouldn't be scared of these debates. We should welcome them, right?
Right.
And be confident in our own ideas and our own capacity to sell, what we believe.
Well, we had a discussion before we went on the air, which was about the lead story in the print edition of the New York Times on Wednesday, title of which is "The Democratic Electorate on Twitter is Not the Actual Democratic Electorate." And a group called the Hidden Tribes Project, which was conducted by More in Common, which is a nonpartisan representative of the YouGov survey of 8,000 Americans, found that the Democratic electorate is both ideologically and demographically diverse. Overall, around half of Democratic-leaning voters consider themselves moderate or conservative, not liberal. Around 40% are not white. roughly a quarter of Democrats count as ideologically consistent progressives who toe the party line or something further to the left on just about every issue. Only a portion of them, one in 10 Democrats overall, might identify as Democratic Socialist based on these recent polls. So that was the big lead story in Wednesday's New York Times. So what do you make of that? I mean, that basically says that the party is more conservative than what I was saying earlier, which is that maybe the center of gravity has shifted, particularly with the young people who are much more open to the verboten word of previously verboten word of socialism.
I think this is a very complicated thing we're talking about here, right? Like I think these terms are complicated. I mean, I'll give you an example, right? I mean, you know, 75% of Democratic voters are pro free trade, right? Young people and Hispanics in particular, and people with recent immigrant experience, are overwhelmingly pro free trade, right? They don't agree with Bernie on these matters, right? They have an ideological difference on this. I mean, there's an expectation of connectedness in the world among young people, right? And so I think that my own view on this is that it's very easy to oversimplify these things. And so I'm more optimistic perhaps, and we just put out a whole piece showing why the arguments that Democrats are moving towards socialism is ridiculous, that in fact the American politician who most resembles Maduro in Venezuela is Donald Trump. And that, you know, we have to start, I think, pushing back on this characterization of us being an ideologically extreme party. Wanting universal health care for all Americans is not an ideologically extreme position. Wanting to have a coherent strategy to combat climate change is not ideologically extreme, right? These are not things that are in any way extremist. And if you are worried about the creep and the power of an authoritarian leader and sort of what happens when, you know, then you should be far more worried about Donald Trump than any Democrat that's on the national stage. And so I think these are all within the realm of the things that we can manage, and I remain, you know, cautiously optimistic that, you know, where we're going is going to be a better place than we've been. I will say this, right? I've been doing this a long time. The quality of the candidates that we have running for president, the thoughtfulness, the seriousness, their ability to connect with voters should be exciting for anyone in either party, right? That who cares about the future of the country. It means that Democrats have dozens and dozens of really talented leaders who can guide this party over the next generation. And that to me is the most overwhelming thing I've taken away from this early presidential race, which is I feel like the party is going to be in good hands for a long time. It's just a question of whose hands it is, and we'll see.
Simon Rosenberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Simon Rosenberg, who's the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News for 5 years before working on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking at how Trump is placing himself above the law as he defiantly fights the move underway by the House Ways and Means Committee to have the IRS turn over the past 6 years of his tax returns. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Edward Kleinbart, Professor of Law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. Before joining USC Law, he served as Chief of Staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. His latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times. The law is clear on disclosing Trump's tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kleinbart.
Thank you very much, Ian.
So, Ed, thanks for joining us. And there's obviously a tremendous resistance from the Trump administration, from the White House, and from Trump himself about giving up his taxes. You know, he's the only president in modern history not to reveal his tax returns or not to make them public. And now his chief of staff, Mulvaney, is saying that the Democrats will never see his tax returns. And the president himself has even issued a veiled threat that he will disclose the tax returns of people like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. So there is a battle going on, but my sense is, and I don't understand why this is not framed this way, is that we have a president who is acting as if he's above the law.
Well, I think there's a lot of merit to your starting point, Ian. The law here is, in my view, in the view of most everyone else, quite clear. The House Ways and Means Committee, which is the relevant tax writing committee that's taken charge on this issue, has the authority to request the tax return of any taxpayer. In my view, and I think most people agree with this, there's a very low bar to overcome to justify doing so. And in this case, the bar is easily cleared. The Ways and Means Committee has a lot of reason to want to look at the president's return and more generally, to look at how the IRS is handling the president's return. And I think that in respect to that, the law is absolutely clear, and the very low burden of justification that needs to be met has more than been satisfied in this case.
So what do you think Senator Mitt Romney meant when he said that the approach by Chairman Neal of the House Ways and Means Committee was moronic?
Well, when somebody says that the carefully crafted position taken by a man like Chairman Neal, who himself is a cautious and thoughtful man, I was proud to have known him a little bit when I was in Congress, when somebody describes Chairman Neal as moronic, I think that reflects more on the speaker than on Chairman Neal. I think Chairman Neal has very carefully crafted his request. That's put it on the strongest possible footing, including his legitimate interest in oversight of the IRS and to ensure that the IRS is, in fact, auditing the presidential returns without pressure from the White House, for example. And there's nothing moronic about it whatsoever. Chairman Neal has both the legal high ground and the moral high ground here. And I thought that Senator Romney's statement was, frankly, over the top.
So, Ed Kleinbart, just explain to us the two-step process that you talked about in your Los Angeles Times op-ed.
Yeah.
The law is clear on disclosing Trump's tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee.
Right. I think it's quite important to understand that the way the statute is written is a two-step process, and each, I believe, has a different level of justification that is required. The first is to request tax returns. As Larry Summers, in his large op-ed in the Washington Post, made clear a couple of days ago, that request goes to the Commissioner of Internal Revenue because there is an official delegation order under which the Secretary of Treasury has delegated the Commissioner of Internal Revenue to handle these requests. That request to obtain tax returns of any individual is on the face of the statute without any condition. Like others, I think that there are some small conditions that are put on that. But, you know, if Chairman Neal had a crush on Beyoncé and wanted to see her tax returns just because he was obsessed with her, that might be problematic. But I think we can all agree that's not the case here. There are legitimate concerns. But once that's satisfied, once the tax returns are delivered to the Ways and Means Committee in this first step, they're confidential. They remain confidential. They're still protected by the shield of privacy in the sense that they're not meant to be publicly released. If someone were to leak them, that would be a felony. If there are sort of remote kinds of situations where Chairman Neal himself could stand up and read the tax return into the record without being guilty of a crime, but those are very far-fetched circumstances. So it's a confidential review. Then the statute says that the committee of the Ways and Means Committee in this first step can only meet in sort of in private, in executive session. Then if the committee votes to release anything to the full House and put something into the public record of the House of Representatives, which in my view would be a report, you know, not the returns themselves, but a report summarizing their findings, when they vote to do that, then and only then, whatever they authorize by vote to go into the public record of the House would become public. And I think that the better view is that the committee should meet a higher standard at that point, because at that point the presumption of privacy is gone, and everybody sees what is released to the public, let's say a report. But depending on what the committee finds in its confidential review, it is perfectly plausible to imagine that that second level of justification might also be met. I can't say for certain because I don't know what would be found in the first level of review, but I think it's important to understand that when Neal gets the returns, they remain confidential, and only in this second step would anything be released to the public, and at that point there should be some higher standard of demonstrated that there really is a good reason for the full House and thereby the public to see that information.
Now, the IRS Commission, of course, his boss is the Secretary of the Treasury, and Steve Mnuchin did testify yesterday to the Financial Services Committee of the House. Yes. And got into a bit of a spat with the chair, Maxine Waters. And Mnuchin, when he was asked if he could comply with the request for Trump's tax returns, he said he would comply with the law, but he stopped short of saying that he would hand over the tax returns. So what's going on there, do you think, Ed?
Well, I think there are a number of pressures being brought to bear. The first is that in a really startling admission, Mnuchin acknowledged that the White House had already meddled, that the White House had been engaged in direct conversations with his staff about this question. Completely inappropriate. Absolutely, the one thing that should never happen is that the president should be putting pressure on this process. That would, frankly, if it ever got to that, it would rise to the level of one of the counts in an impeachment resolution. Second, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin sort of made a real strategic error. I mean, he should have said this responsibility has been delegated to the Commissioner of Internal Revenue pursuant to delegation order blank, blank, blank. Therefore, I have nothing to say about this process. I will not be involved in this process. The Commissioner will get has gotten the request. Commissioner will review it, and the Commissioner will act according to the law. I can't for life of me understand why Mnuchin hasn't distanced himself from the process, because by distancing himself, he would again be demonstrating a lack of political intervention. He's a political appointee, and the fact that he is sort of keeping himself in the middle can only be explained by the fact that of tremendous pressure that he feels from the White House. Absolutely the wrong thing for him to have done tactically and in terms of how the law is supposed to work.
So the way that the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Richie Neal, has framed this requests for Trump's tax returns going back a number of years, along with returns of some of Trump's companies, is about their prerogative of making sure the IRS is properly auditing a president's tax returns, and that's
exactly
written into the law.
Exactly.
But have other things affected this? In other words, for example, the testimony of Michael Cohen, which almost he almost set up a flare, saying, you know, he's cheated on his tax returns. He overvalues his assets when he needs to, and undervalues them when he pays taxes.
Well, you know, this happened in Watergate. One of the great Watergate scandals was Richard Nixon's criminal tax evasion. It turns out that he backdated documents, inflated valuations in order to create a phony tax deduction when he gave his personal records to, I believe it was the Library of Congress. The IRS gave him a pass on that when they audited him, because it turns out that if you are, the technical tax term, if you are a schnook at the IRS charged with the responsibility of reviewing the tax return of the most powerful man in the free world, you don't come out swinging. And so the IRS gave Nixon a pass. When Congress got involved, and it was a complicated story, in the end there was so much scandal that Nixon invited Congress to look at his tax returns, they concluded that there was, in fact, tax evasion here. It was a major issue that the IRS had simply not pursued properly. The same could happen here, absolutely. Whether it will happen, whether that's accurate, whether Michael Cohen was accurate in his claims, well, that's what the process is about. You can't answer that question in the abstract. You got to sit down and do the work.
Well, apparently, for prosecutors, inflating your assets to get a bank loan is like just the easiest case to make. And it looks as if that's been a pattern in Trump's history. And obviously, he lowballs it for his tax returns. So do you think that over the years, I mean, I've been reading all these books about Trump's past, and it's just shocking the kind of association with Russian gangsters buying condos, all the murky loans from Russians who've bailed him out, and also from Deutsche Bank. A lot of it is very, very murky, and I'm wondering whether that's at issue here, because what we've just learned about the IRS, and as you know, the Republicans keep cutting the budget of the IRS,
yeah,
so they can't really audit a lot of people, and they spend an awful lot of time ordering the earned income tax credit, which is done by computer, and that takes
up congressional order, effectively.
Yeah,
right.
By a congressional order, so that wastes a lot of manpower. What little manpower they had, so they're deliberately made dysfunctional by the Republicans. And my understanding is that it's really clear across the board that much higher percentage of just ordinary low income folk trying to make a living are getting audited, and people like Donald Trump just aren't getting audited.
Well, it is true that the IRS is systematically under-auditing the most affluent. Their tax returns are the most complicated. Their lawyers are the most aggressive and pushiest and most difficult for an IRS agent to deal with. This is a national travesty. But when you come back to focusing on Trump's returns, is it possible that one would find systematic tax avoidance or even evasion? Well, yes. What's the evidence of that today? Well, there are various books and Michael Cohen's testimony. But the most telling, indirect reason to think that this sort of close review is necessary is sort of the hysterical response from the president himself. It's not a rational response. A rational response would be to say, okay, you folks can review the returns, you have the right to do that, but I want an agreement that you won't take the second step. You won't make anything public except a high-level summary on which I sign off. That would be a rational place for a publicity-shy president to be, but the hysterical kind of tone that the president has adopted does signal to you know, any third party, that there's something that is terribly concerning to him. Maybe it demonstrates a great deal more interactions, commercial transactions with Russian nationals. Maybe it demonstrates this, you know, or that tax evasion. But none of that will be known unless and until Ways and Means does its work, and then Ways and Means decides that there's something so important that it ought to be in some way communicated to the public. So I don't like getting ahead of that process, except to observe again that the president's kind of hysterical tone, as echoed by people like Chief of Staff Mulvaney, make me very concerned that there is information there that would be very troubling to the American people.
Well, just in closing, Ed Kleinblatt, to my mind, I think it's pretty clear that Trump has just lied and lied and lied throughout the campaign. When he was ever asked about why he's the first president in decades not to release his tax returns to the public, he kept saying, "I'm under audit, I'm under audit." That's pretty easy to prove, isn't it? Even though the IRS, of course, has a confidentiality, and that would probably prevent them from saying, no, it's not true. But it sounds to me, and it seems to me, that it's simply not true.
It might be not true. I have some of the same personal intuitions that you do, but your and my personal intuitions aren't how this should play out. What should play out is a serious review by Ways and Means Committee, confidential review, employing their specialized staff and the staff of the Joint Committee on Taxation. And the Joint Committee staff has been for almost 100 years as closely guarded an outfit as Bob Mueller's attorneys, to do that work and then decide whether there's something to report back to us. I don't like relying on personal intuitions. What I would like to see is that the process start to move forward.
Right, but isn't it untrue that you cannot release your tax returns to the public if you're under audit?
Oh, of course that's not true. Of course you can do anything you want. They're your returns.
Right, well, that's what his mantra was all the way.
Right, and it may well be that they're not under audit. It's certainly the case that the IRS cannot confirm or deny. Mm-hmm. If, in fact, it turns out that they weren't under audit, well, then it seems to me the first thing is that the Ways and Means Committee in its confidential review should find out whether the IRS is now auditing the back years. And then the Ways and Means Committee can consider whether that untruth, if it turns out to be, in fact, an untruth, whether that untruth is significant enough that it should be communicated to the American people.
Well, Edward Kleinblatt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Edward Kleinblatt, who's professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law, who served as the chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. And his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times. The law is clear on disclosing Trump's tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.